You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, more men are starting to leave the workforce to be caregivers at home, full or part-time. We'll look at what's driving that trend and how it's affecting children and parents. Now, after the Christmas holiday snowstorms, Southwest Airlines canceled more than 5,000 flights over 2 days. Southwest says they canceled almost 70% of their flights during and after the rough weather. Other airlines had problems, but none of them came close to that level of cancellations. The canceled flights left many travelers confused about what to do, where to go, who to call, and many people who lost their flight with Southwest are still trying to find their luggage, including at their stops in Milwaukee. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg talked about the canceled flights last week.
Well, meltdown is the right word. This is an unacceptable situation. You look at the number of passengers who are stranded. You look at how hard it is even to get somebody on the phone to address it. From what I can tell, Southwest is unable to locate even where their own crews are, let alone their own passengers, let alone baggage. I conveyed to the CEO our expectation that they are going to go above and beyond to take care of passengers and to address this. They indicated a number of issues that they're having with systems, legacy systems for managing their schedule and where their crews are. But the bottom line is the rest of the aviation system has been on the road to recovery.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you fly over the holidays? Did you deal with weather issues when traveling, regardless of which carrier you were flying with? Did you or someone you know have a flight canceled? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kyle Potter is the editor of Thrifty Traveler, a travel site helping people find cheaper flights and understand the ins and outs of airline booking. Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here, Rob.
Well, for some context, let's set Southwest aside for a moment. We had a big storm. All airlines had trouble. How did they do compared to past, say, big storms?
You know, it's been clear for, you know, the better part of the last 2 years that the airline industry is pretty fragile across the board, that, you know, whether it's bad weather or, you know, air traffic control issues or a labor dispute, that there are these, you know, contributing factors that lead them to start to fall apart much quicker than they used to. And, you know, I think the saving grace for some other airlines in the, across the country, you know, including Delta and Alaska Airlines, was that things just got so awful for Southwest that it obscured the, you know, what really is the larger problem, which is true across the entire airline industry, which is that, you know, these airlines have stretched themselves really thin coming out of the worst of the pandemic, trying to carry as many passengers as possible. And, you know, they're just one bad storm or air traffic control issue away from canceling hundreds, if not thousands, of flights. So, you know, other airlines struggled. It's just that Southwest did so, so poorly.
Yeah. We'll dig into some more of those fundamentals. But let's key in on Southwest here on days when, like, a Delta might have canceled 200 and some flights. Southwest is canceling 2,000 and some flights. And I keep hearing, like, cascading or meltdown. What were the factors that led to this ongoing trouble with Southwest?
You know, first, I just want to say this was not just unprecedented. This is going to go down, at least for now, and I hope it stays this way, as the worst airline meltdown in the history of aviation. I think we can safely say that now. And when an airline is canceling this many flights, I mean, we're talking 2,500 plus flights a day for 4 or 5 days in a row, more than 2/3 of what they were supposed to operate, it's never just one problem. So it started, as it did for every airline, with that really nasty storm heading into Christmas. And, you know, that in particular for Southwest, though, you know, Southwest wasn't the only airline that was affected by weather. But, you know, Southwest and some of their most important airports, including airports like Denver, Midway in Chicago, and Baltimore, I would add to that list, got hit really hard by the storm. So that got them off on a bad foot. And then, you know, the snowball started to pick up some more momentum, you know, from the fact that Southwest runs its airline a lot differently than most of the other major airlines. You know, airlines like Delta and United use what's called a hub and spoke model. So they fly out of their hub to another city, and then they fly right back to another hub, and they just do it over and over again. Southwest flies point to point. So their planes just basically fan out all across the country from point to point to point to point. Planes might cover the entire nation. And when things are good, that works really well for them. But when problems start to mount and the snowball starts to roll even faster, it makes it even harder to recover. And then finally, the Achilles heel that I think we all see now with Southwest is that they have some really bad, outdated infrastructure issues that they use to run the airline behind the scenes. And so in particular, in this case, an antiquated crew scheduling system that they turn to when all of these problems start to mount in order to try to get people where they need to go, their crews and their planes to make sure that these flights are staffed. And, frankly, that system just broke, and Southwest was not able to recover, in part because, with that system not functioning properly, they were trying to manually call up and email thousands of pilots to get all of these flights staffed, and that's just not workable.
Talking to Kyle Potter, editor of Thrifty Traveler, looking at air travel over the holidays, the big Southwest meltdown. You heard Kyle said unprecedented meltdown in the industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. If you work or have worked in the airline industry, love to hear your thoughts. If you flew over the holidays, love to hear from you. If it went perfectly smoothly, or if you were one of the many stranded somewhere, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Andy is with us in Appleton. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I understand the current CEO is much more investment-minded of Southwest Airlines. The previous one was only focused on return on investments for shareholders and put an accountant in charge of a lot of the decisions. So they were functioning for years and years by one quarter to the next quarter for returning on a stock price, which is kind of reflective of what's almost wrong with capitalism in America these days. When I work with Japanese companies, they had 50-year plans for our company, and we've got one quarter planned to get a bonus for the CEOs based on the stock prices. And what happened recently is a reflection of all that lack of investment for infrastructure.
Interesting.
Yeah, Southwest Airlines. So,
Andy, thanks for the call. Kyle, is there something to that? If I'm worried about my next quarter returns, I maybe not get invested in updating my antiquated computer system if I'm not taking that long-term view?
There's no question this is part of it, right? Every airline in the country at this point is a for-profit public company. And that is what they are built to do. That is what their shareholders, their owners instruct them to do. And updating this kind of software is not cheap. There's no question about that. There is, however, I think another layer to that, a little bit of nuance, which is that replacing a system like this is really daunting. And while everyone may be saying, you know what, we need to replace this. This is really outdated. It's only a matter of time before it fails us. Airlines are almost impossibly complicated systems. And I do not envy an airline CEO who has to make these calls, let alone all of the people involved in operations, because it really does only take one thing to go wrong for the entire system to start to spiral and fall apart. And so I think there has been to this point at Southwest, and this is true at other airlines too, it's the devil we know. Kind of approach to things. And at this point for Southwest, clearly it's they waited too long. They really need to do this. I trust that they're going to do this as soon as possible because they cannot afford for this kind of high level failure again. But there is just kind of that human doubt element of it too, where it's just a really daunting on when you're not sure exactly how things are going to go. And it's such an important piece of running the airline among all of those millions of moving pieces.
Thanks for that call, Andy. We're talking to Kyle Potter, editor of Thrifty Traveler, looking at the thousands of canceled flights from Southwest Airlines over the holidays, what that company's doing about it coming up, what you can do about it if you have some costs associated with cancellations. Find out what kind of recourse you might have. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your holiday air travel experiences for better or worse. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Kyle Potter, editor of Thrifty Traveler, about Southwest Airlines canceling thousands of flights right after the Christmas holiday, wider issues in air travel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Kyle, wanted to ask, you know, if someone has been left in the lurch by, say, Southwest in Milwaukee or elsewhere, what, if anything, does Southwest owe them?
Well, on paper, not a whole lot, because, you know, the reality is that travelers in the United States just have shockingly few rights. There's no legal guarantee to compensation for your trouble. There's not even, you know, Southwest isn't even obligated to put people up in a hotel or cover additional meal costs if they strand someone overnight. The only real right that is enshrined, at least in U.S. law, is that if Southwest canceled your flight, if you don't want to rebook on a different day that they offer you, you can scrap your trip and get a refund. That's it. And, you know, Southwest has set up a page, you know, if you just go to southwest.com, among other options, which I'll get to, they have a form that you can fill out to start that refund process. That really is it. Now, in this case, Southwest is under a lot of pressure, you know, from federal regulators, as well as just, you know, brand protection, to step up and do right by people. So Southwest has said that they will cover, quote unquote, reasonable requests for reimbursement for some of the additional costs that people faced, you know, for the last week and change of these troubles. So, you know, booking a last minute flight that might cost an arm and a leg, or, you know, a rental car to drive instead of fly Southwest because you couldn't fly Southwest, and meals and hotels and all of this. Now, the problem here is that Southwest is the one that gets to decide what's reasonable and what's not. So they have, you know, at southwest.com, this page set up to submit, you know, reimbursement requests for this. But it's anybody's guess at this point exactly what they're going to cover. I hope they cover every dime that people submit. And then, you know, beyond that, it's a big open question how long it's going to take, particularly because there is an absolute mountain of these requests coming in, and I doubt Southwest is equipped to handle it pretty quickly.
Let's go back to our callers. We've got Ren on the line in Martindale. Ren, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
A little bit about, so I really appreciate your comment regarding left in the lurch. I ended up flying with Spirit Airline, which I now believe is obsolete, about last year in November. And they canceled the flight without informing any flyees, for lack of a better term. And I had paid full price to go from Colorado to Detroit. And then when I tried to get back, they canceled the flight. They did not comp for hotel or anything. And then I got a refund of $51.63.
That was not, I assume, full price, Ren?
It was not, sir.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for that. Why would we see just flights randomly getting canceled? Are we seeing staffing shortages lead to that, Kyle?
You know, go down the list of airlines from American to United and everywhere in the alphabet in between. And, you know, it has been a perfect storm of problems for the last 2 years. But the underlying problem, you know, is the same, whether it's Southwest, you know, this winter, or Spirit last summer when they had a big slew of issues, at Delta this past summer as well. I mean, airlines shrank a lot during the worst of the pandemic when that hit in, you know, March and April of 2020. They winnowed their ranks by tens of thousands of staff. And that was really good and important, at least financially, for a while, because they just didn't need that many people. But, you know, travel has come back fairly fast within the last year in particular. And airlines just don't have the people that they need in order to operate the flights that they're selling to the public. At least the underlying problem between all of this is that the margin between everything going smoothly when you know, problems don't enter the mix, whether it's a storm or air traffic control or whatever else, the margin between everything going smoothly and things going catastrophically wrong is too thin right now because airlines are trying to do too much with too little, and they all have been for the better part of the last 2 years. You know, that's the problem to me.
Thanks for that call, Ren. David joins us now in Raymond. David, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Two questions. The first one is sort of practical, legal. The other is I'm going to ask the guest to look into his crystal ball. The first one is when it comes to device tracking trackers like Tile or AirTag, do FAA regulations speak to their legality, and are there any carriers that just say, no way, you can't use them? That's question one. And question two is an airline goes down. The idea, here's this crystal ball, where the government forces on the carriers association, something to the effect that, okay, one carrier goes down, then by regulation or whatever, they are required under certain conditions to get you a seat on some other carrier's plane, and that other carrier, if they've got the seat open, is required to accept the transfer.
David, okay. And just to your first question, David, you're talking about things for tracking our luggage. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I mean, okay. Yeah, exactly. That was all over the news.
Gotcha. David, thanks for the call. Kyle, do airlines let us do that? Can they stop us from doing that?
You know, there was a big hubbub about this over the summer because, you know, one airline, a German airline named Lufthansa, put out some statements that seemed to suggest that, you know, these kind of Bluetooth type trackers wouldn't fly, that you couldn't put them in the cargo hold and therefore couldn't put them in your checked bag. And things went back and forth for weeks. And what it basically came down to was everyone verified that these devices are safe, that there's no problem to put them in your luggage. And I would be absolutely gobsmacked if we get to a point where anywhere in the US, even around the rest of the globe, tries to crack down on the use of these devices, especially because they're so important right now for people to have some certainty that they know where their belongings are.
And then he also asked about, can it be required that, hey, if Southwest can't get me in a seat, they have to get me a seat on another line. Now, I understand there are agreements among different airlines. Some of them have them, some of them don't. Could that be a requirement in the future?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if regulators look at this. You know, I think we're still in damage control with Southwest in particular of what needs to change. And a lot of the conversation in the near term is going to be about what Southwest needs to do to make sure that this doesn't happen with Southwest again. But there absolutely needs to be a broader conversation about what needs to happen across the entire industry to make sure that people aren't left in the lurch again when this kind of mass disruption happens. And, you know, if I have a crystal ball, the only thing that the crystal ball is telling me is that airlines are going to, you know, have these kind of mass disruptions again. They might not be on the same scale, but it will happen again. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if, you know, Secretary Buttigieg at the Department of Transportation looks at some kind of mandatory interline agreements, which is, you know, what the industry calls it, to make sure that airlines can place their passengers more easily on another airline when their flights get delayed or canceled. Exactly what that would look like, I don't know. I don't know that there's a way to compel it, but there might be a way to make sure that more of these agreements are in place so it's easier to shift passengers to another airline if need be.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Kyle Potter with Thrifty Traveler, looking at air travel after the holiday meltdown at Southwest. Back to your calls now. Boo is with us in Fish Creek. Hi.
Hi, Sue.
Oh, Sue. I was wondering about that. Sue, that makes a lot more sense.
Okay. I have a light note story. We went Green Bay, Seattle and back, had delay leaving Green Bay, but in that, the gate workers were incredible. One of the women grabbed a microphone. She said, we're having holiday trivia. And everyone just started shouting out answers. The whole mood of the terminal changed. They had prizes for people who got the correct answer. And they made a situation because we were 4 hours late getting off. They really changed the whole situation. So hats off to, you know, the workers who are on the ground with the airlines.
Sue, thanks a lot for that call. And Kyle, that was sounds like a pretty happy situation. Those workers effectively on the front line working those gates, they got the worst of it in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad Sue had a great story about things going well and people responding well, because the opposite has been true way too much. You know, look, I can be pretty hard on the airline industry and you know, call them out when I feel like they've failed Americans, and I think they have a lot, but it is never the fault of a gate agent when your flight gets delayed or canceled. It's never the pilot's fault. It's never the flight attendant's fault. It is never anyone's fault that you see in the airport or on your plane when your plans get canceled. So while I know that it's frustrating and it's so tempting to, you know, take it out on someone, I hope everyone's takeaway, especially after seeing some of the really, really troubling footage of Southwest agents bearing the brunt of this, you just need to be kind when these things happen, because it's not their fault. And, you know, if nothing else, being kind to someone who has the power to help you gives them all the more reason to actually help you get where you need to go.
We have just a minute or so left. Kyle, do you see the airline industry trying to have in the future more slack, more excess staffing and capacity, so they aren't on that razor's edge between everything's cool and meltdown?
Boy, I hope so. You know, this was a Southwest meltdown. But the problem is bigger than just Southwest Airlines and its technology and the way that it runs its network. So I hope that there are some lessons here for the rest of the airline industry. You know, up until, you know, this last week, things seemed to be much better in the airline industry, that, you know, through a combination of cutting some flights so they weren't running so razor thin, and bringing on record numbers of new employees, that they were starting to grow out of some of the growing pains that we had seen again and again over the last 2 years with these delays and cancellations. So I hope that trajectory continues, and I hope that they all take a good hard look after what happened with Southwest last week, that they look at what else they can do to make sure that they're not the next Southwest. And if they don't, it's probably only a matter of time before we see another airline canceling thousands of flights a day. Even
thanks to our guest, we'll leave it there. Kyle Potter with Thrifty Traveler, looking at the future of air travel after the Southwest meltdown. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau show that the percentage of men in the U.S. labor force has been declining steadily for years. At the same time, the percentage of men who report being a stay-at-home parent has been going up. The group represents a relatively small fraction of the overall population, but the trends are showing no signs of slowing down. And in opposite-sex couples, it has gone along with a rise in women as the main sources of household income. Our next guest has researched those trends in recent years to find out what kind of impact they're having on parents and families. We're looking at that now, and we want to hear your story, too. Have any of the men in your life left the workforce to be stay-at-home dads, full or part-time? Are there women in your life who are the primary earners for their families? Let us know by emailing ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Noelle Chesley is an associate professor and sociology department chair at UW-Milwaukee. I talked to her about this last month. Here's a listen. Well, now, historically, household roles, I think, have been kind of gendered, certain responsibilities split between men and women. What have been some of the downsides of those traditionally, I guess, defined gender roles?
Well, I mean, the downsides are definitely a lack of flexibility, right? When you've got people who specialize in either taking care of the kids or in working a job to earn the family income, if either one of those areas gets disrupted and a person can't do them for one reason or another, it makes it very difficult for the family to respond at that point.
Now, I mentioned some national stats out there showing a steady increase in the number of men taking on those household caregiving roles. There are different ways to measure it, of course. What are you seeing out there as you've looked at research over the past decade or two?
Right. Yeah, you're right. There's people do argue a little bit about the numbers and the trends and sort of how to define this. I think what's really important for your listeners to understand is that staying at home without any employment is not very common for either men or women. I mean, in today's world, among couples and people who have children, it's much more common for either both members of a couple to be employed, for single parents to be employed. And we do still have families where there's a full-time at-home caregiver. It's much more likely to be a woman than it is to be a man. But there have been more men entering that role. This is something that we really started to talk about and see a little bit more right after the Great Recession. So right around 2010, I think this was a pretty hot topic. And it sounds like it's reviving a little bit now with some things that are out in the news.
I want to talk about the cultural response to this. In my youth, there was a movie called Mr. Mom that was all about the hilarity that ensues when the dad
yes.
is the household caregiver. Is there still sort of that, I don't know, discomfort or weirdness that people feel about it?
I think so. And I will tell you, I've interviewed families where there's a stay-at-home parent who is a man in the family. And many men that I have talked to hate Mr. Mom. They hate the movie. They hate the name. So definitely don't like that. Feel like it's a little degrading. And yeah, I think there still is some stigma around switching up these roles, actually both for the women who become primary earners for their families and for the men that take on that primary caregiving role.
Can you talk about the economic factors that are leading to some people doing this? I did it myself for a couple few years there where I was working part-time from home and being Mr. Mom, I guess, for the little kids in the house. What is driving people to do that? Again, not the dominant majority, but what is leading to some of those trends?
Yes, I think that in many ways you could view any kind of a move, especially for men, I think, to become full-time caregivers as symptomatic of really sort of a lack of good, affordable childcare options, and also a commentary on demanding jobs. So I think what a lot of families find in general is that it's tough to find good childcare. It costs a lot. And so that definitely is a consideration that many families have to take, have to think more about and strategize a little bit about how they want to meet their caregiving needs. And then there just is a problem with jobs being pretty demanding. And so it can be difficult to substitute for the kind of family support you need, especially if both members of a couple have really demanding jobs. So you'll sometimes see, especially in you forwarded me a Bloomberg piece, you know, there's discussions about people who have two really demanding jobs. And once kids are in the picture, even with, say, a great nanny, they just can't manage that.
We're talking to Noelle Chesley, Associate Professor and Sociology Department Chair at UW-Milwaukee, looking at caregiving men. Trends show men taking on caregiving roles more at home, maybe being, it's rare, full-time stay-at-home dad or part-time, part stay-at-home dad. Women more commonly becoming the breadwinners. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, and also love to hear your experiences wherever you are on these trends yourself, your own family. If you are a dad who's taken on more caregiving roles, love to hear from you. What kind of response do you get? Do you get called Mr. Mom? Do you hate it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, we focused on part one of what we're talking about here, the men maybe being more likely to be caregivers. Also, the trends I mentioned earlier on, Noelle, women being more likely in a two-parent household to be the primary breadwinner, when in the past, usually if a woman was the main breadwinner, statistically it was a single-parent family. What are you seeing in that?
Yeah, well, here I think part of what we're seeing with women and their earning potential is a result of more and more women investing in education. So I can't remember exactly when this happened, but a few years ago, some of your listeners might have remembered reading in the paper something that we now had more women entering college, for example, than men. And that was really positioning a lot more women for these more demanding and often higher paid jobs. And I think that's happened at exactly the time that we've sort of been building on a longer standing trend of declining manufacturing jobs, the wages at some of those jobs that were traditionally done by a lot of men, and especially a lot of men who didn't have more formal education after high school. wages and opportunities in those sectors of the economy have gotten a lot tougher. So I think there's been, you know, it's a pretty complex mix of a lot of different things going on in the economy, but certainly we're seeing that more and more women are going to be better positioned for higher earning jobs. And as those women marry and, you know, start families, it's going to change the calculus a little bit about how to meet these different needs, about who should work, who should really stay home and take care of kids.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, John.
I was listening earlier, and you were talking about men staying home. Well, my wife and I had an interesting relationship in that I work nights and she worked days. So I would stay home with the kids and take care of them during the day. And then while they were sleeping, she would be there to take care of them.
Now, John, that sounds hard to me. I mean, working night shift is tough as it is. What was it like being a child care provider on top of that?
It was very tiring.
I bet.
I didn't get much sleep for about 3 years.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Noelle, sounds like you want to jump in.
Yeah. No, I love that John added that to the conversation because it's a good reminder about some of the different strategies that families do come up with to handle, you know, this sort of conundrum about how to earn money and how to take care of especially small kids. And what he describes is definitely something that we study and that gets talked about among work and family researchers such as myself, this idea of families having different shifts or trying to manage shifts so that they can always have that 24-hour parental care is something that families do engage in. A lot of families, like John mentioned, find it to be difficult. It can be stressful, and it can also be associated with higher rates of divorce with some of the research that we've seen. Sounds like John was successful in managing that in his own life, but it comes with its own challenges too. He mentioned being really exhausted, and I'm sure he and his wife didn't get to see each other there for very much for a while.
John, thanks so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. This is a fun thing to recall for me because I worked at a daycare center in Seattle in 1987. So I saw this trend years ago that the dads would drop the kids off. They'd pay $3,000 a month. They were very wealthy, and I would take care of their kids during the day. But I knew men in Portland, Oregon, when I lived there in 1886, who were lawyers, and they would run their law office out of the house, and they would stay home and take care of the kids. I applaud it because it's very intentional parenting. It's very intentional family planning. I really like that idea.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Some experience from the 80s there, Noelle.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. I mean, one of the great things about some jobs is that it is possible to combine them with childcare during the day. Although I think, especially having just gone through the pandemic, there are parents out there who would talk about the struggles with that. And I'm also just thinking about that commercial, or maybe it was a I think it's the commercial where the little kid comes in and is interrupting his dad on the Zoom call. A little more recently, but not without its challenges to try to do all that out of the house.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We're talking to UW-Milwaukee sociology professor Noelle Chesley about a rise in stay-at-home dads and female household breadwinners. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your family? How have you juggled things to make things work with childcare and the employment world? If you are a dad who has taken on most or all of the daytime or nighttime childcare role, love to hear your experience, the reactions you get maybe from friends and family. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Noelle Chesley, Associate Professor and Sociology Department Chair at UW-Milwaukee. With us today, looking at a growing trend of men leaving the workforce to be stay-at-home dads or part-time working and stay-at-home dads, and women serving as household breadwinners more often. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234. Karen joins us now in Monona. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I'm driving. I apologize. When I had my third child, when we had our third child, and at the age that he was two, I had to divorce his father because I was the late breadwinner doing the child, about to do the child care. I was teaching at the time, and what happened was that was what I did. I continued doing child care until the kids were gone and then found another job. I turned into an apartment or a property manager, but since I was late into the career doing that, I still, in my 70s, have to work to make up for the lack of Social Security, et cetera, that allows me now to retire.
Karen, thanks for the call. Karen, bring up an important experience. I had the kids after divorce, single parenting, and navigating the world of work. Noel, we're talking about, well, which parent? Well, what about when which parent is the only parent?
Yeah. Actually, what Karen describes is pretty common for a lot of women. You could also almost think of it as the caregiving penalty because for scholars who study especially poverty at the end of life, one of the reasons we see so many women struggling financially is because of a lot of the time that they either took away from employment completely to engage in care for their families, or because they had to take that more flexible, less well-paying job to sort of accommodate those responsibilities. So I think her story really illustrates that broader pattern that we see oftentimes in the population.
Karen, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We'll go to Alberto in Milwaukee. Alberto, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring
up?
I was listening to you guys talking about this, and not even the expert here has talked about love and attachment. The attachment the kids get from the parents during those years, how important it is. The same importance the attachment of the kid to the mother's breast milking. No drinking formula. The love and the whole is this. The conversation until now has been very transactional, very, very much about money and talking about breadwinner, which I was saying to the person that took the phone up. The breadwinner is a phrase from the 50s that shouldn't be used anymore.
Alberto, thanks a lot for the call. And actually, honestly, I've been saying breadwinner. I don't like that phrase either that much. I just don't have a better shorthand. But Alberto's point about the attachment and a lot of dads, I appreciated having that opportunity when my kids were littler. It isn't just about the money, Noel.
Absolutely. Yes, I can definitely talk about that. Thank you so much for sort of turning the conversation in that direction, Alberto. And also on the breadwinner thing, I completely agree. We could just say primary earner,
yeah,
or, you know, larger earner or something like that. But one of the things I thought I could mention that I actually discovered in my own investigations of families who were taking this on is that one of the men who took on the role of being a more involved, more primary caregiver to their children oftentimes found that to be really transformational for them. And it's exactly what Alberto's talking about. I mean, they came to value the work that they were doing in the home, their relationships with their children really deepened in a way that, men would often talk about it in this very kind of transformational way. So I don't think we want to completely think about it as like, the work-family equation and how much does childcare cost and all those other things, even though those do weigh into family decision-making.
Thanks a lot for the call, Alberto. We'll go to Tony now with us in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi, this is Tony. I did just want to chime in that I was a full-time stay-at-home dad. Actually, still am, I consider myself. But I started back in 2003 when our second daughter was 6 months old. We also had a two-year-old at the time. We actually had options for childcare, but really, my wife and I wanted to do the parenting, the majority of it, at least ourselves. So that was probably the prime factor. My wife had a successful career in real estate, so that was the I I was an engineer, so her opportunities to bring the family income was much greater than mine, and that turned out to be a great decision. But that was kind of the main thing, and I'll tell you from my perspective, the hardest thing to deal with was the generation of men older than me. They could really not understand that I would actually give up my career to do this and stay at home. The guys that were my age kind of thought more that, that this, I was retired. They would call me the stay-at-home mom and all that. They were more jealous. But I found it hard to deal with the generation a little bit older because they just could not understand me giving up my career. So that was the challenges and the enjoyment I had with staying at home with my kids.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Tony. Yeah, definitely, I think some generational attitude changes Tony is reflecting there.
Yeah, I love Tony's story. It sounds a lot like many of the families that I talk to. I mean, different in the details, but just some real central themes. You know, I think for families that have two professional parents, so it sounds like he said he was trained as an engineer and his wife had a job that was also, you know, potentially higher earning. What he described is really typical. I mean, this idea that the parents really value this idea of parental care, and they sort of make the decision to have one person stay home to sort of uphold those values. I will say that there are some real different experiences for families that are not quite in those economic circumstances. So it can feel like less of a choice there for those families.
Thanks a lot for the call, Tony. Gretchen is with us now, also in Milwaukee. Gretchen, hi.
Hi, I'm Gretchen.
What did you want to tell us about Gretchen?
So I'm a teacher at Milwaukee Public Schools, and my husband is a full-time stay-at-home dad, and he is just, like, absolutely rocking it. But, you know, when he goes out and about, he'll take the kids to the zoo or he'll take the kids to the park, and he always gets comments from a lot of, like, probably more so older women, he says the most, and you know, they'll say like, oh, looks like, you know, you've got your hands full. It looks like mommy's day off, or it looks like you're babysitting today. And it just drives him totally nuts because, you know, this is his every day. And typically when I have the kids, I'm the one with my hands full. So it's just kind of unfortunate that people, you know, feel like they have the right to make those comments. So it's just kind of too bad.
Interesting, Gretchen. So we heard about the older men from our last caller. Now the older women, too, kind of not quite getting it, Noelle.
Yeah, I think both of those stories together do really illustrate kind of the lag in attitudes in the broader society and sort of the realities of what families are actually doing in their everyday lives.
Gretchen, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last minute, Noelle, we can't predict the future, but what kind of trends, what kind of things are you watching for when it comes to who provides the caregiving in our households?
I certainly think that families, given the situation that we're in now with the potential for all sorts of disruptions in both employment and the rise of caregiving, I think families are going to have to be really, really flexible in how they deal with this. And more men are going to be pitching in and taking care of both their aging relatives and their young kids. And people are probably going to have to take turns and do different shifts and figure out all sorts of ways to try to manage this moving forward.
Noelle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yep. Thank you.
Noelle Chesley is an associate professor in the sociology department, chair at UW-Milwaukee. I talked to her last month about a growing trend of men leaving the workforce to be caregivers at home, women serving as the primary source of income in more households. Still time for you to share your story. How do the caregiving responsibilities break down in your household? Have you or a man in your family left a job to focus more time on the home? How's it been going? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Governor Evers was sworn in for a second term today, setting the stage for a big year in state politics. At the top of the list, the two-year budget will be in the works. What will compromise and cooperation look like between the Democratic governor and the Republican legislature? Will those be words? We say a lot. We'll get a preview of some of the big stories. And the U.S. Postal Service is switching to more electric vehicles in its fleet, along with other big changes in the works. We'll get the latest on the future of mail service in the U.S. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.